This is NPR.
Support for Morning Edition comes from our members and Rainbow, America's country store in Ukiah and Lakeport, featuring Aviderm natural pet foods. Aviderm provides balanced nutritional essentials for your dog's skin and coat. Available at Rainbow Ag, a locally owned store. More information can be found at rainbowag.com. You're tuned to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, K201 HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Good morning. It's Wednesday, December the 9th. This is a permissive burn day between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. in Mendocino County. Coming up, another hour of Morning Edition from NPR, then Democracy Now! At 8 with Amy Goodman. Then at 9, Jeff Blankford speaks with author and researcher Grant Smith about his new book, Spy Trade.
Good morning. The U.S. will pay billions of dollars to
America. It reveals the opinions on U.S. foreign policy issues of 642 members of the prestigious Council of Foreign Relations, which is one of those self-selecting organizations like the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderberg Group that's suspected by many of pulling the strings that determine U.S. and world global policy. When it comes to U.S. Middle East policy, however, the poll indicates it clearly doesn't. What it does reveal is that the overwhelming majority of those polled, 67% or two-thirds of the members of this elite foreign policy institution, believe that the United States has erred over the years in favoring Israel. And moreover, they don't consider Israel to be much importance to the U.S. in the first place. The poll was conducted almost simultaneously with one that asked similar questions of 2,000 members of the general public. What can be concluded from the answers to questions that dealt with the Israel-Palestine conflict is that the public forms its opinions from what it hears and reads in the mainstream media, which is largely biased toward Israel, while the Council of Foreign Relations members have greater access to accurate information on the subject and are less susceptible to pro-Israel propaganda. That apparently not a single U.S. newspaper saw fit to report on the opinions of CFR members, and under those circumstances and given the results, this is not surprising. When you hear the results, you'll see why. First, CFR members were asked which countries they thought would be the more important as America's allies and partners in the future. They were allowed to select 7. Just 4% of them included Israel, which placed it in a tie with South Korea, and far behind China with 58%, India 55%, Brazil 37%, European Union 19%, Russia 17%, Japan 16%, the UK and Turkey 10%, Germany 9%, Mexico 8%, Canada, Indonesia, Australia, and France at 5%. When asked which countries would be less important to the U.S., Israel at 9% finished behind 22 countries, including Canada and Mexico, and in the region, Turkey, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. What was particularly revealing is that, quote, in the dispute between Israelis and Palestinians, only 26% of the CFR members sided with Israel, compared with 51% of the general public. While but 16% of the CFR side with the Palestinians compared to 12% of the public, 41% of the CFR sided with both equally, as opposed to 4% of the public. Supporting neither was 12% of the CFR and 14% of the public. As the CFR has not had a major hand in formulating U.S.-Israel-Palestine policy, it is clear from what I mentioned earlier that 67% of Council of Foreign Relations members believe the U.S. has favored Israel too much. Saturated with pro-Israel propaganda, only 30% of the public felt that way. At the same time, only 2% of the Council, as opposed to 15% of the public, believe that U.S. policy overly favored the Palestinians. The polls only came close in the questions whether U.S. policy struck the right balance. That was a position of 24% of the CFR and 29% of the public. Regarding Iran, one detects the same difference in response to pro-Israel propaganda. Whereas a 64 to 34% of the poll Council on Foreign Relations members see Iran as a major threat to U.S. interests, compared with 72 to 20% majority of the public, only 33%, a third of the CFR, would support an attack on Iran should it get a nuclear weapon, as contrasted with 63% of the public. Again, all those figures were taken from two Pew Research Center polls conducted during a six-week period, the beginning in early October to mid-November, one on the Council for Foreign Relations and one with the general public, and yet not a word about the CFR poll has been reported again, as I mentioned, by the mainstream media. With Iran apparently not having given in to U.S. and Western demands for ending its nuclear enrichment program, House Democratic leaders are planning to move forward with a bill imposing tough new sanctions on Tehran before the holiday recess, according to Southern California Democrat Howard Berman, the bill's co-sponsor, along with Republican Ileana Ross-Leitinen, Cuban-born representative from Florida. The legislation, House Resolution 2194, as I've reported in the past, is intended to cut supplies of refined petroleum products, especially gasoline, into Iran as a means of pressuring it to end what Berman and his 340 co-sponsors claim is Iran's nuclear weapons program. Additional sanctions would be imposed on foreign exchange, banking, and property transactions, including any organization that does more than $500,000, $500,000 worth of business related to Iranian fuel imports. Berman, chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, has said the bill might be taken up under a parliamentary process that allows quick approval of widely supported legislation. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee passed similar legislation at the end of October, but Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has not yet said when he'll bring it up for a vote. If passed, the bill will present serious problems for President Obama, since China, Russia, India, and Turkey, among a number of other countries, have major contracts with Iran that run into the billions, and the United States would be in no position to enforce the bill's sanctions against businesses in those countries. It should be mentioned that having a major hand in crafting this legislation was a pro-Israel lobby, AIPAC, some of whose questionable activities will be the subject of today's interview. Passing this legislation has been at the top of his agenda for months. And by the way, Congressman Mike Thompson is one of the bill's co-sponsors. As for Chairman Berman, speaking for the Sherman Oaks Homeowners Association in February of 2008, he said, "Israel is why I went on the Foreign Affairs Committee," and then he corrected himself, "it's part of why I went on the Foreign Affairs Committee in the first place. I'm a great supporter of Israel," end quote. Thanks, Howard. We never would have guessed. And now let's turn to Afghanistan, where President Obama has announced that he has authorized the sending of 30,000 more U.S. troops, among the goals of which will be the capture of Osama bin Laden, which General Stanley McChrystal believes will break the back of the Taliban. You may have heard recently that, according to a Senate report, bin Laden was within reach of U.S. troops in the mountains of Tora Bora in December of 2001, but that General Tommy Franks decided not to pursue the al-Qaeda leader with massive force. The Senate report asserts that the failure to kill or capture bin Laden at his most vulnerable moment has had lasting consequences beyond the fate of one man. Bin Laden's escape, it says, laid the foundation for today's reinvigorated Afghan insurgency. It is probably also forgotten that, as the Guardian of London's Rory McCarthy reported back on October 17, 2001, senior sources in Pakistan had told him that a senior Taliban minister offered to hand over bin Laden during a secret visit to Islamabad, and for the first time, wrote McCarthy, citing a source close to Pakistan's military leadership, the Taliban offered to hand over bin Laden for trial in a country other than the U.S., without asking to see evidence first in return for a halt to the bombing. The Taliban had previously told Washington that it would hand over bin Laden if the U.S. could provide evidence of his complicity in 9/11. U.S. officials apparently dismissed the later proposal, wrote McCarthy, and are instead hoping to engineer a split between the Taliban leadership. That's in The Guardian, October 10, 2001. Then you may recall back in 1996, the government of Sudan offered to turn bin Laden over to the U.S. to keep him from going to Somalia, but then President Clinton declined the offer, and bin Laden then left to set up camp in Afghanistan. I suppose it may have occurred to a number of you, long before this, that the U.S. finds it more useful for its global agenda to keep bin Laden at large. If so, it is likely that President Obama may not be in the loop and has simply made the choice he has to send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan because he lacks the backbone to tell the public the truth that he is fighting an unwinnable war. On November 16th, the British journalist Robert Fisk, who twice interviewed bin Laden and has spent a considerable time in Afghanistan, was interviewed on Dutch TV about his work as a longest-serving Western journalist in the Middle East and his thoughts regarding President Obama and the war in Afghanistan. Segment runs about 5.5 minutes, and let's give a listen to Robert Fisk.
Some of your critics some of your critics say that you've lived too long in the Middle East.
Look, this,
so
is
you
an
become...
old, this is an old game. If you haven't been there long, they say you don't know the situation, you're naive. If you've been there long enough to know what you're writing about, they say you can't see the wood for the trees, you've been there too long. Excuse me, the longer you're in a place, the more you learn.
Why do you stay there in Beirut?
I got a job at one point. I got the offer of being an East European correspondent, and I would have reported the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of Yugoslavia. But I did report that anyway because it was the old Ottoman Empire. I suppose because covering the Middle East is a bit like reading a great novel, Tolstoy's War and Peace, Anna Karenina, and you sit up and you say, well, just, you know, it's almost midnight, just one more chapter. And then you say, well, I'll just read the next chapter to see what happens next.
But the never-ending
novel. But before you know it, the dawn is coming between the curtains. You've been reading all night because you want to know what happens next.
Yeah.
And that's why I stay in the Middle East.
It's a never-ending
novel.
That's
right, yeah. It'll go beyond my lifetime.
And without having...
But I still want to know what happens next. It's a great human tragedy, and I cannot draw myself away from seeing what happens next.
You're one of the very few Western journalists to have interviewed.
Bin Laden is going to be an albatross around my neck.
Yeah, we
for the
just
rest
want to know one thing. Is he still alive?
Yes, he is.
Yes? Yeah. How do you know that?
I know it. He's alive. I promise you.
You sent emails to him, or...?
I don't use email, I don't use the internet.
No?
Absolutely not. No, I think that the internet and the email particularly is the death of literature and language. Everyone who writes to me has to write real letters, and I write real letters back. Mm-hmm. But he's alive.
You know,
is he still dangerous?
I think he's irrelevant. Look, bin Laden, from his point of view, his success is he created Al-Qaeda, which exists. If the monster exists. He's as relevant as nuclear scientists if you want to get rid of the bomb. You can arrest all the nuclear scientists in the world, and you can execute them, but you've still got the bomb. It exists. Al-Qaeda exists. It doesn't matter what you do. If bin Laden falls down a crevasse or has a heart attack or watches too much television, it doesn't make the slightest bit of difference.
Yeah.
He's irrelevant now.
Mm-hmm. Can Obama be a blessing for the conflict in the Middle East?
No, Obama is totally weak. He's impotent. He cannot... You know, we like to think that a former prime minister will agree with me. Governments are not about good guys and bad guys. They're about power.
What if I'm again Mr. McCain during the election
campaign? Governments are about power and the use of power, and you will agree with this.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's not about good guys and being nice. I went to Cairo to watch Obama make his famous hand reaching out to the Muslim world. There were problems in that speech. He talked about the relocation of the Palestinians in 1948. I mean, like the relocation of the Bosnians in the Serbian War, and I don't think that I do. But Obama, he cannot change the way in which power works in Washington, and he's not going to be able to. And why he has lent his name to the Afghan war is beyond me, because it is going to be a disaster. The right wing in America say, we call it the graveyard of empires. It's a cliche. It is a cliche.
What should
he say? It's true. Get out.
Get out.
More and more, I've been 33 years in the Middle East now. By all means, we should send the Muslim world, our doctors, our teachers, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But we're always going there and offering democracy and freedom, and we're arriving with our tanks and our Abrams M1A1 tanks and our Bradley fighting armored vehicles and our horses and our swords. We're always promising them freedom. And I calculated the other day that we now have 22 times as many military personnel in the Muslim world than the Crusaders had in the 12th century. And that land does not belong to us. It is not ours, and we should leave militarily. We should take all our soldiers out. It doesn't belong to us.
Mm-hmm. So Obama isn't any better for the Middle East than George Bush?
No, he's worse because he offers better but will not be able to give it. At least with Bush, you knew where you stood.
Hmm.
He was going to be a disaster. Noam Chomsky is a friend of mine. He and I were talking in Dublin three days ago. And he said to me, you know, he got the Nobel Peace Prize. He's done nothing for peace. He's talking about Obama. But at least he did better than the rest.
Uh-huh. He didn't deserve the Nobel Prize.
He should have turned it down. Uh-huh. He should have said, look, I'm humbled, but give it to me later.
He did say that he was humbled and that he didn't
deserve it. Yes, but he took it. He took it, you see. He got the Nobel Prize for public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Can you still be optimistic about the
future
and the conflict in the Middle
East? I'm totally pessimistic about the Middle East. There's no, it is incendiary and is getting worse. There's nothing good about it. You know, one of the strangest and saddest things when I'm in Kandahar or Kabul or Baghdad or Beirut and I watch the television and I see Obama or I see Gordon Brown, our wonderful British Prime Minister, or I used to see Tony Blair, and the Middle East they speak about is not the Middle East I live in. They are totally divorced from reality.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, that's a sad way to end it.
It's tragic. It's worse than sad.
And worse than sad it is. That was the voice of Robert Fisk being interviewed on November 16th by Dutch television. I'm going to leave the last word to NBC's Jay Leno, who the other night told his audience, quote, I'm trying to sum up President Obama's first 11 months in office. He gave billions to Wall Street, cracked down on illegal immigrants getting health care, and he's sending 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan. You know something? He may go down in history as our greatest Republican president ever, end quote, Jay Leno. It's now 20 minutes past the hour, and I have my guest today on the telephone, Grant Smith. Grant is one of the country's foremost investigative journalists, and as I said a year ago October when he was last on this program, one of his best-kept secrets, since the focus of his work has been on uncovering the hidden history of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, Israel's officially registered Washington lobby and the most powerful in the nation's capital. As Director of Research at the Washington-based Institute for Research Middle East Policy, or IRMEP, he has produced 6 books, Deadly Dogma, How Neoconservatives Broke the Law to Deceive America in 2006, which we spoke about at the time, Foreign Agents, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the current scandal, that was in 2007, Declassified Deceptions, A Secret History of Isaiah Kennan and the Rise of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, also 2007, America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's Battle to Register the Israel Lobby as Agents of a Foreign Government, which he spoke about last year, and most recently, Spy Trade, How Israel's Lobby Undermines America's Economy. Welcome once again, Grant Smith, to Takes on the World.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeffrey. It's just a real privilege.
Going through your books, that tells an amazing story in and of itself. Most of my listeners have heard from me over the years about how AIPAC's control over Congress has had a crippling effect on what is left of our democracy. But I expect that few are aware of what is done on Israel's behalf that has damaged our economy. And from the title of your book, and certainly from its content, it seems AIPAC went outside the law to do it. What do you mean by that title, Spy Trade?
Well, spy trade is really an interplay between the trade relationship the United States has with Israel, which is very unique, and the espionage, which has plagued the U.S.-Israel relationship since 1948. So this book is really driven by a mass of declassified and recently released documents under the Freedom of Information Act, as have been the previous books you mentioned. And it really delves into how this trade agreement came to be and strips away kind of the superficial veneer about this agreement, which as the first free trade agreement, or so-called free trade agreement, is vitally important and will be celebrating, if you can say that, its 25th year next year.
Maybe you give us some details of how this came about. There wasn't a great deal of publicity about it at the time, as I recall. And the U.S. was also involved with the Iran, what they call Iran-Contra war in Central America, which seemed to have some connections to it.
Sure. 1979 is probably a good starting point, which was a calamitous year in terms of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which threw Israel out of that vital market that it was getting a great deal of benefits for in its partnership with the Shah. It was the Nicaraguan overthrow and the beginning of the Reagan administration's war against the Sandinistas, the so-called Contra War. And what we have in terms of the free trade agreement is a very hard push on the part of the Israeli government and AIPAC to open up the entire U.S. market to unrestricted Israeli exports as a way of rewarding it for its support in various international intrigues, some of them which were really authored by Israel, including the Iran-Contra scandal, in which they were proposing to trade arms that they had gotten from the U.S. Under various aid regimes for hostages, but which quickly turned into a huge mess and scandal. But in the midst of all of this, they floated a free trade agreement as a compensation reward, good politics to Reagan, and they began negotiating a fast-track process. The veneer of the agreement is that major U.S. Industry groups from Monsanto and Dow to the FL-CIO, the small growers in California, were all invited to submit their concerns about opening up the market in a formalized process here in Washington, but found that the process was not at all an advice and consent process. They basically gave the International Trade Commission and U.S. Trade Representative industrial secrets, market share, product costs, all sorts of vital trade secrets in the interest of presenting their case about why this agreement should not go forward. All that information was bundled into a classified report that the USTR promised would be used to negotiate the best possible agreement, but the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee mysteriously obtained that report and began using it against these U.S. industry groups in the massive PR campaign, and more troubling, to help Israeli industries carve out various niches using proprietary information that was really not available anywhere else. The FBI documents that we retained after about a year and a half long battle and various Freedom of Information Act rejections, appeals, and whatnot, documents that the Israeli Minister of Economics, Dan Halpern, was the one who obtained this document. And you must remember this was going on at the same time as Jonathan Pollard was stealing military secrets, and at the same time that the Iran-Contra scandal was really peaking. So there's a lot of sort of interrelated economic espionage, military espionage things going on, and covert operations in conjunction with the CIA, should be mentioned. But so Halpern obtains this report and passes it to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee in a coordinating meeting, and then they now have access to all of this vital intelligence to successfully counter any sort of industry opposition to the agreement. Well, fast forward to 1985. You know, Reagan's been reelected on a landslide. Congress is, convinced to pass the agreements. And essentially, this entire FBI investigation, all of the concerns raised by this massive usurpation of intellectual property of U.S. industry, is just quietly folded into a classified file and never talked about again. So spy trade really looks at the origins of this first free trade agreement.
Well, the story I was actually reported, the FBI was investigating the stolen, or in a sense it had to be stolen, or document of proprietary information, was reported in the Washington Post at the time, and like so many incidents involving Israel, it gets very little little or no editorial comment.
Well, this is the kind of story, this is the kind of story that is just so far outside of the narrative of two allies, you know, fighting terrorism in the region, that the mainstream press has simply no capability for examining this sort of thing.
Well, it's interesting in the Iran-Contra hearing that Israel was heavily involved but was never mentioned by name.
Right. Well, that's one of the reasons I go back through that, because we're continuing to get a steady flow of documents about Iran-Contra. The biggest files, however, which are held at the Department of Defense, are still classified, and they're still fighting in spite of the new Obama regime of responsiveness to FOIAs. They're still fighting tooth and nail to avoid release of three of the most important documents related to Israel and Iran-Contra. And that, I think, shows you kind of the sensitivity within the U.S. government for releasing these documents, because it really shows how this relationship functions, and it directly refutes the, the sort of public relations that you've been discussing.
Well, it's interesting that you have corporations like Monsanto and Dow, which are among the most powerful politically in this country, and yet, and they weren't alone, when they go up against AIPAC,
right,
they lose.
They lose, and they continue to lose. In fact, some people might think that the power of the pharmaceutical industry, given our current healthcare debate, is insurmountable. But even so, pharmaceuticals right now are one of the major concerns and the most active opponent to some of the egregious behaviors under this particular free trade agreement, this pharma and all of the major pharmaceuticals, which kind of like the industries, the 71 industries, which saw their intellectual property and market information concentrated and released to exactly the parties they didn't want it to. When U.S. pharmaceutical companies go into Israel, they're required to release their clinical dossiers with all of their important formulas, which have been immediately transferred to parties in Israel's counterfeit pharmaceutical and generic pharmaceutical regimes, which are in a regulatory regimen that's totally outside of WTO and international norms. So kind of the abuse that took place at the beginning of this agreement continues at the end, and the USTR does sanction Israel for its treatment of the U.S. pharmaceutical industries, but I think it just goes to show kind of the power imbalance, the fact that they've been able to take on this powerful industry in the last few years and win.
My guess is Grant Smith, author of Spy Trade, we're talking about AIPAC and its effect on the U.S. economy and our political life as well. I should point out that when the U.S.-Israel signed the free trade agreement, there was celebration in South Africa, the South African Financial Times. This is apartheid South Africa, which was Israel's ally. Published a color illustration of a hourglass which showed South African products going into Israel then into the United States, because this trade agreement allowed South African material to be processed through Israel to come to the United States. It's just another little side effect of what Israel was doing at the time. I should recall even the Black Congressional Black Caucus was humbled into being silent and not protesting loudly about Israel's arms trade to South Africa.
Right.
It's interesting also, protesting against that agreement was the governor of Arkansas at the time, Bill Clinton.
Right.
Maybe you could talk about that and the bromine question.
Sure. Bill Clinton led a delegation from Arkansas. They were among the first to testify in this process. Really on behalf of the U.S. Bromine Alliance. And the U.S. Bromine Alliance represents one of the few very highly successful industries that the state of Arkansas had, which was bromine products, which are derived from old salty seas that have evaporated. But at any rate, Clinton testified along with Dale Bumpers and a bunch of others against the agreement because they didn't want to compete against the Israeli state-run bromine industry, which would have been extracting from the Dead Sea. Well, the bromine industry was among the first to complain to the USTR and the International Trade Commission because they wrote a very proper and straightforward letter saying which of our business classified data passed to AIPAC and the Israeli governments. And the ITC didn't want to tell them. It was as though they were the enemy. And finally got permission because they considered it to be classified information, said, well, essentially all of your information went to the Israelis, so kind of tough luck. And they kind of held off on their response until after Reagan was elected, but they were in a tough situation. They wanted to preserve their industry. They actually went out and gathered thousands and thousands of signatures from across rural Arkansas from people who were probably would have been opposed to any trade agreement, but were opposed to this because they didn't want to compete against a foreign state-run organization exporting to the U.S., and none of those citizen petitions, which are all in the public file at the ITC, and none of the entreaties by Clinton and his group had any effect whatsoever. And it continues to this day. I mean, the industry concerns are mitigated. They're just not having any impact.
And it's interesting when President Bill Clinton, or President-to-be Bill Clinton, started his campaign for president. The first person he hired as a staff member was a lawyer from AIPAC named David Ifshin, and he came to be known until George Bush came around as the best president Israel ever had. What has been the economic impact overall of this agreement since we have now 1985?
Right. Well, the economic impact is stark. Back in 1985, when this was signed, the U.S. had a 27% share of the Israeli market. It plummeted to 12% last year. So all of the AIPAC lobbyists said that the U.S. would, you know, do well to have 40, and this agreement would help the U.S. get to 40, and it hasn't. Meanwhile, the U.S. is essentially open to unlimited Israeli exports. The cumulative deficit is $71 billion in terms of the overall performance since 1985. And if you look at it on a year-by-year basis, for the past 10 years, that's been equivalent to about 100,000 U.S. jobs. So this has a direct impact on the economy. The other thing that I think is important to look at is also the intellectual property aspect of it. The U.S. has essentially opened itself up to numerous abuses of weapon system, pharmaceutical, and other very closely held intellectual property, which is flowing, and for which U.S. Employers and holders of intellectual property are not compensated. Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, the other thing to just mention is that in terms of bilateral agreements, this is out on an extreme, because if you look at the U.S. Free trade agreements with places like Australia, with places like Jordan, with places all of the countries with which we've had long-standing bilateral agreements, I'm not talking about NAFTA, the performance has generally been positive. And I think the fact that this is an anomaly in terms of delivering benefits mainly only to one side just sort of underscores what was going on to actually pass this agreement.
Now, it's interesting. I mentioned in a previous program that in California alone we have a $5 billion free trade imbalance with Israel.
Mm-hmm.
This was... with the Californians, there are a number of states that have chambers of commerce, special trade relations with Israel, and they seem to be still, despite the downturn in our economy, trying to send more money to invest in Israel.
Right. Well, no one ever talks about the macro numbers. What you'll hear from different interest groups, like the U.S.-Israel Chamber of Commerce, is, oh, this state exports $200 million, and they don't do the actual, what's the actual net deficit or net surplus. So, but that's true. Economists who were looking at this potential agreement back in 1984, who had no dog in the fight, were saying, well, this is just another form of aid. So why don't we just give more foreign aid instead of doing this, because it kind of defeats the purpose of calling it free trade, because it won't be. But those arguments kind of on the basis of economic fact and reality, didn't, of course, carry the day.
I'd like to switch gears for a moment and go back to one of your earlier works in which you talk about the efforts of the Justice Department under Bobby Kennedy, when John Kennedy was president, to pressure AIPAC, or the American Zionist Council, which was its precursor, into registering as a foreign agent, and how they resisted that successfully until President Kennedy was no longer around to push it.
Yeah, I think that has a lot of direct bearing on the theme of the day, which is Iran. Well, the five-minute history of the development of the lobby is basically that, you know, back in 1938, among the first organizations to register as a foreign agent active in the United States with the U.S. State Department and then the Justice Department was the Jewish Agency, which was an organization encapsulated in the vision of Theodore Herzl for a corporation that would promote immigration to Palestine. Well, this was also an organization, and David Ben-Gurion, who actually filed as a foreign agent operating out of New York for the Jewish Agency, put together a vast network in 1946 to smuggle World War II surplus arms, men, power, and equipment to Israel. And sort of this ethos of special access began at that point when, after the FBI got wind of all of this activity taking place across the United States, had a high-level summit with Jewish agency officials in which they said, well, a lot of legitimate organizations and people could be hurt if you crack down on this. None of this weapons smuggling is going to affect the U.S., so please leave us alone. And there was sort of this expectation of high-channel, high-level immunity being born from this time. In 1952, David Ben-Gurion, who was now prime minister, not head of the Jewish agency, had a high-level summit in which major organizations such as Hadassah and the Zionist Organization of America and others would now be under a new domestic umbrella called the American Zionist Council, which would sort of be the focal point, the transmission shaft for the relationship between Israel and U.S. activists. This caused some consternation with the Eisenhower administration. They accused the AZC of using tax-exempt charitable donations for lobbying, for arms and aid, and put a lot of pressure on the American Zionist Council, which also received a lot of pressure in 1962 when the Kennedy administration Justice Department found that it was continuing to receive financing from the Jewish agency. It was basically reusing tax-exempt donations that were raised in the U.S. and other countries, sent to the Jewish agency. It was funneling those back into political activities, public relations, and building up lobbying startup groups across the United States. They found that the equivalent of $35 million had been used by the American Zionist Council from the Jewish agency improperly in the U.S., and that it was not declaring itself as a foreign agent, which it should have been. J.W. Fulbright conducted hearings in 1963 about this in April and August. He was always trying to get more information about the Jewish agency's relationship with the Israeli government, but was denied that information. But later in 1970, a rabbi and a lawyer successfully lobbied the Department of Justice and the Jewish agency to declare its 1952 covenant agreement, showing that it was really essentially an arm of the Israeli government with all sorts of privileges in the Knesset and financing from the Israeli government. And so they had to shut down and reorganize. And so in the 1970s, AIPAC reemerges, or the AZC reemerges as AIPAC, and the Jewish agency reemerges as the World Zionist Organization in New York. They just simply filed a new foreign agents declaration, didn't even change their office location, staff, or publications. And so now what we have today is really a super American Zionist Council, in which its executive committee is now composed of 52 organizations. It's hardwired to the Israeli government via the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, which sort of functions like the old AZC umbrella. It's in the same building as the World Zionist Organization, American section. And so you have this superstructure of the lobby, which has only grown in influence despite the order by the Department of Justice, but really engaging in the same activities, same types of initiatives, and refusing to register as a foreign agent. So I think, you know, the most important thing about all of this is that one of the reasons Kennedy was leaning so hard on the lobby in the 60s is that he didn't want Israel to go nuclear. There were a lot of people in the United States who wanted Israel to have nuclear weapons. There was, of course, the whole question of NUMEC and the suspicions that 500 pounds of highly enriched uranium was diverted by Israeli spy Rafi Eitan to the Dimona nuclear weapons facility. And so Kennedy in 1963 was fighting hard to get U.S. inspections of Dimona. He was sending letters to the prime minister. He was insisting that they not go nuclear. And fast forward 46 years later, and Americans are being asked to engage in economic warfare, basically, through sanctions and a well-defined roadmap toward actual military strikes, in the name of preserving Israeli nuclear hegemony, which is, you know, a hegemony which their elected leaders were opposed to and did everything they could to prevent. And so we're in this strange moment in which the advice and consent power of the American people through their elected representatives was entirely subverted by a lobby that's now insisting that they take dangerous steps toward preserving a capability which their elected leaders were originally opposed to. So there's kind of a five-minute history of the lobby and how it continues to have a major role in what's going on today.
Well, that's a good roundup. It's also interesting to mention an example of their power that no American president is able to even speak publicly about Israel's possession of nuclear weapons. There was an unwritten agreement supposedly made between Richard Nixon and Golda Meir, the Israeli prime minister, back in 1969, that if Israel would not test the missile, the United States would not talk about it. But in 1979, there was a test, an atomic test off the coast of South Africa, which was believed by the CIA and others that this was a joint missile test between Israel and South Africa. That was quashed as well. And today, you see the President Obama, or before him President Bush, and before him President Clinton, talking about Iranian nuclear weapons and not mentioning that Israel has them when the whole world knows it.
Right. It's bizarre, and it's really, I think it goes against the grain of sort of the American psyche of questioning everything and being, you know, insisting on talking about reality as opposed to these almost, you know, Soviet style ways of managing doctrine and the way you should speak about things. But, you know, I do agree. I think the president, you know, he's only the president, and he's faced with this interconnected elite which has, you know, fairly well-defined foreign policy goals, and we see that his own foreign policy goals, such as freezing illegal settlements, are virtually meaningless against the power of this group.
So. Well, they brag about their control of Congress, and it's been a fact, an arguable fact for years, that even, as I've mentioned on this program before, it was not mentioned in the mainstream media, that before he met with Netanyahu, 76 senators, three-quarters of the Senate, sent President Obama a letter, as did 330 members of the House, telling him not to put pressure on Prime Minister Netanyahu, essentially taking the side of a foreign country against the President of the United States. And to emphasize that during the congressional recess, you had 55 members of Congress, 30 Democrats and 25 Republicans, going to Jerusalem, holding press conferences, including the Democratic Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, standing with Netanyahu, saying settling and building more Jewish settlements in East Jerusalem was okay, which was against U.S. policy. It's extraordinary, but there's no other country in American history in which members of American Congress have gone and stood with the president of the other country against the president of their country. It defies reason, except you look at the funding for the political parties. The Democratic Party gets between 60-75% of its funding from wealthy Jewish donors who support Israel, and that's unfortunately the problem. The time is 10 minutes before the hour. My guest is Grant Smith. If you have any calls for Grant, questions or comments for Grant, the number here is 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. This, which you mentioned earlier about the illegal transfer of weapons to Palestine, to Jewish fighters in Palestine before 48, was looked, the government looked the other way when they realized, well, this is not going to be used against the United States. But that kind of mentality that they could get away with this seems to have permeated the lobby ever since. And we have the case of, you might mention about Rosen and Weissman, Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman, the two AIPAC officials who were arrested for passing information. It was a sting, actually, and passing information on to the Israeli embassy and to a journalist at the Washington Post, but they made this a First Amendment issue. Perhaps you could talk about that.
Yeah, I think it's really important because you have the case of Rosen and Weissman. You also have the more blatant case of Stuart Nozetti, who was arrested in an FBI sting operation. But it's sort of this value system, this ethic of the smuggler, which began in 1946 in this country, holds that a crime committed in the name of Israel shouldn't really be treated as a crime. And the U.S. has generally gone along with that, up through the very, I would say they were wacky judicial decisions going on with the Rosen and Weissman case. At one point, the judge, toward the end, was ordering the prosecutors that they didn't have to, that their burden of proof wasn't proving that Rosen and Weissman were taking sensitive national defense information and channeling it not only to the Israelis but to friends in the media who could put it to good use in the campaign for U.S. military strikes on Iran, but that they had to prove that they were in a state of mind in which they believed their actions weren't illegal. And so, of course, the prosecutors had to throw the case at that point, and in fact, in their decision to drop the case, they cited the almost impossibility of securing convictions because the judge had been successfully, over the course of years of pretrial maneuvers, to place burdens of proof that just made it impossible to secure a conviction under the 1917 Espionage Act, all the while being attacked for anti-Semitism, being attacked for staging an unfair persecution of organized Israel lobby organizations. And so the trial, if you read the actual documents, as opposed to sort of the framework with which it was generally presented by the Washington Post and New York Times to the public, which was that Rosen and Weissman were somehow reporters out, you know, doing investigative journalism when they were changing through restaurants and in the train station and obtaining all of this classified information. If you strip away all of that and look at what was actually going on in court, you see this sort of incredible capitulation of the ruling judge T.S. Ellis to ridiculous claims made by the defense. And so they threw this case. And now we have what I think is a change in tactics where the FBI chose not to go after one of the organizations which really came out of the 1946 smuggling era, which was Israeli Aerospace Industries, which was headed by a person who was actually, you know, convicted of a felon but never served any prison time for smuggling weapons out of the U.S. Nozetti was thought, it appears in his indictment, to have been trafficking in classified national defense information to Israeli aircraft industries. But because of the potential involvement of the State Department or other ways to derail the case, it looks as though the FBI tried to get a very tight set of confessions and admissions from Nozzetti by having an FBI employee pose as a member of Mossad to set up payments for classified national defense information. And it looks as though they've really got a strong set of complaints against Nozzetti for at least attempting and actually receiving money for giving classified information to someone who he believes was a foreign agent. Now, whether the District of Columbia Superior Court is capable of resisting this sure onslaught of all sorts of spurious charges remains to be seen. This case simply demonstrates that this economic spying and trading relationship, which we write about in the book, Spy Trade, it's going on. It's a live issue, and although the mainstream media won't talk about it, it's something Americans should be aware of.
Stuart Mazzetti, I should say, was a NASA scientist with top secret clearance who has been providing information to Israel aerospace industry for 10 years, and the FBI set him up as a sting, asking him if he wanted to be a paid agent for Israel, for the Mossad, and he said, by all means, he thought he was already working for them. We have a number of calls here. I'm going to get a caller on the phone here. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, my name's Robert Kurzfeld, and I see the trickle-down effect of this in families, in Jewish homes. You know, like, if I said something about the settlements, if I bring up things about Israel controlling the Congress, if I, no matter what happens within even our own homes, you're considered an anti-Semite, the Holocaust gets thrown in your face, and yet so many of us who sincerely question and who are, you know, believe that the real love of Israel would be to bring it to a just let's put it this way, the torment of these settlements happening beyond the borders of that country that was formed has racked our families, our lives, our country now. And as this information comes out, you know, Howard Zinn did a speech called The Holy Wars and showed how people, you know, become what they battle. And that's what I've seen of our culture. You know, we've become the oppressors now, and how that affects us inside is turning, you know, people into cynics. This lobby that your guest is talking about is so powerful, it renders everybody almost to pull away from action. You know, it's hit a point where, you know, families are standing against families. And I was wondering, with all this information and all this that you're presenting, I think it's fantastic to bring it into the light. But what can we do? You know, what kind of action? It gets more insurmountable as the story grows.
Well, I could say Congressman Mike Thompson is a part of this, as I mentioned. He has voted for every piece of legislation that Israel, the lobby, has asked him to vote for. And he is a co-sponsor of the sanctions bill in Iran. He is holding a town hall meeting on the air tonight. There's a phone number. I don't have the phone number here. It'll probably be announced in tonight's news. He needs to be asked about why he does this, what his position is, and why he takes a position. But thanks very much for your call. We have just time for one more call. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning, Jeff. Jim Houle.
Hi, Jim.
Wondering if your guest is familiar with the book that came out last year by Treaty Parsi called Treacherous Alliance. It looks at the Israeli and Iranian relationships from what I'd call the old Hans Morgenthau perspective of the battle for power between two regional powers, and that what we really have going on here is the battle where Iran in many ways controls the Persian Gulf. Israel controls much of the rest of the Arab world, and that the struggle is reflecting Dimona and the nuclear capabilities of Israel and the fear of a countervailing.
Jim, I'm going to stop you there and see if we can answer this. We're near the end of the hour.
Yeah, I mean, that's clearly what we've been talking about. And Treaty Parsi, should be noted, is he's now the target of a vast campaign to change him as a foreign agent. So it's funny how these things develop.
Grant, we're coming down. I want to get people's information for people about how they could get the book, how they could contact you and your website. First of all, your website.
Yeah, the website is www.iremep.org. If people go to that, they can link and take a look at the book. There's an independent bookseller in the Middle East, Books, who's our preferred retail vendor, who has the book well stocked. You can also get it at other online booksellers. So iremep.org.
I also recommend to our listeners, we have a number of really good independent bookstores here, that they go to the bookstores and order the book at the bookstores and have the bookstores get it. The book is Spy Trade by Grant Smith. Again, Grant, I want to thank you very much for another great program, a very informative program on a very important issue.
I sincerely appreciate it. Thank you, Jeff.
Take care, Grant. Bye.